David Kilcullen says the main problem with traditional counterinsurgency efforts is that the use of military force by an outside power galvanizes locals against them. Those locals join the insurgency, not as ideologues, but as defenders of their physical and cultural space. Kilcullen calls these locals accidental guerrillas. That's also the title of his new book. Now, Kilcullen's no dove. He's been an on-the-ground military officer in Indonesia, East Africa, and the Philippines. He's also been an advisor to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and was the architect of the troop surge in Iraq under General Petraeus. And he's currently an informal advisor to the Obama administration. He told Steve Paulson that the accidental guerrilla makes up some 90% of a typical insurgency.
In Afghanistan, one of the local officials said to me, look, 90% of the people that you guys are fighting that you think are Taliban are actually tribals, and they're fighting for tribal honor, for local self-interest, or because they lost a relative or there's some other reason. Less than 10% are actually ideologically committed to the Taliban. In Iraq, we did a survey at the start of the surge of the motivations of the people that had been detained in Iraq since 2003, and we found that about 70% of the people that had been detained had been motivated primarily by economic motives. About 20% had been motivated by, you know, they were a member of the former regime, or one of their family members was killed, or there's some other reason. Less than 10%, again, in the case of Iraq, were ideologically or religiously fanatics that were aligned with al-Qaeda.
So if we focus on Afghanistan, what do these 90% want? Basically, is it just to get the United States out of Afghanistan?
No, it's much more complicated and local than that. And in fact, in the Afghan context, the United States still has an approval rating across the board of around 64%, which is about the same as President Obama has in the United States. So we're not particularly unpopular across the board in Afghanistan.
So you're suggesting then that if for most of these people there is no particular ideological commitment to this war, their minds could be changed, that they could come to see the United States as an ally, as potentially helping them.
Yeah, I think what we did in Iraq, which worked very well, and which was actually copied from some of the work that we had done before that in Afghanistan, was to identify who the irreconcilables were. And as I said, we found that that was a very small number, and deal with those people while simultaneously trying to co-opt and reconcile and make peace with the vast majority of people who are willing to reconcile under some circumstances. And we actually found that the thing people most wanted was protection. It turns out that even people that hate the Taliban would rather have oppression under the Taliban than chaos and anarchy. And so providing a certain amount of order and protection, making people feel safe, was the fundamental thing that we've had to do to bring people to our side. And economic and governance benefits were a close second behind that.
So how do you provide protection?
I think the most important thing is you have to build a genuine partnership with the people that you're trying to protect. And that sounds all kind of wishy-washy, but it's actually very practical. You've got to live amongst the population. You've got to demonstrate that you stand shoulder to shoulder with them when they're attacked by the enemy. And you've got to be present 24 hours a day and protect them where they sleep. In Iraq, in 05, 06, we had a lot of times when we would move into an area, we would clear it, and then for some reason we'd have to go away again, and the people that had been working with us in that area would be vulnerable, and the enemy would come along and literally cut their heads off. And when we would come back into the area, we'd say, well, where are all those people that we worked with before? Well, they're dead. And those that are still alive are no longer willing to cooperate with you because they saw what happened to their friends last time around. In order to break that cycle, we had to get in and live with people and prove to them that we were not going to abandon them to the tender mercies of the enemy when it suited us. In Afghanistan, that fundamentally means getting away from the business of chasing the Taliban main force units, which are out in the countryside, and instead getting into the population centers where most people live and focusing on protecting them 24 hours a day. More of a police kind of activity than a military one.
So I guess the question is, to fight al-Qaeda and its allies, should we define this as the war on terrorism, or is that a misnomer? Are we actually talking about something different here?
I think, well, you know, the Bush administration used the term war on terrorism, although they tried a number of other terms as well. I think there's always been some dissatisfaction with that term. I noticed that the Obama administration aren't using the term either. the fact is it doesn't really matter so much what you call it. It's more a matter of what you do. And we need to get out of the business of large-scale, unilateral military intervention in other people's countries. Invading a country in order to deal with a small terrorist group in that country is not a smart way to go. In Indonesia, we chose never to send military or even heavy police units to deal with Jamaah Islamiyah, which is the Al-Qaeda ally. Over time, our approach of backing and working with the Indonesian people and working with the Indonesian government, which is obviously now a democratic government, has really borne fruit to the point where a whole element within Jamaah Islamiyah is now saying, look, this is pointless. Let's give up the terrorist struggle because we're not going to get our objectives that way. Let's rejoin the peaceful political process and try and get elected to parliament. But, you know, when a terrorist group decides to give up terrorism and instead return to the peaceful process of politics, that's about as close as you can get to a victory in a counterterrorism campaign. Killing individual terrorists, you can do that forever. You're not going to defeat the terrorist movement. But convincing the terrorist movement itself that it's pointless to continue, that's the holy grail. And we did that in Indonesia by staying out of the process and working through local legitimate partners rather than trying to come in there unilaterally.
It sounds like you're saying that the United States should simply pull out all of its troops from Afghanistan. I mean, just put in people who can help protect the villages, work with social services, but get the military personnel out of there.
Well, there's an apparent paradox here because the best way to deal with this, I think, is not to intervene in the first place. But it turns out that when you do intervene, you simply can't deal with it just on the basis of civilian agencies because they immediately become a target for terrorists and get attacked. And if you think about what happened to the aid workers in Somalia in the early 1990s, that's an example of that syndrome. And so you end up sending military forces to protect them and you find yourself back in a firefight. So it turns out that I think most people know that I was against the war in Iraq and I thought we shouldn't go in there. But once you've gone in there, the situation changes and it now takes a lot of troops and a lot of time to actually protect people and make them safe. And civilian agencies can't do that by themselves. So it takes a long time and a lot of money and a lot of troops to fix the problem if you do go in. We know how to do it, but it's very costly and time consuming. And that's the best reason for not doing it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth pointing out that you also worked in the Bush administration. I mean, you were an advisor to Condoleezza Rice and you were a key advisor to General Petraeus and the whole troop surge in Iraq.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, it's to their credit, I guess, that they knew that I was against a lot of the policies, but were big enough to accept that and still listen to what I had to say. I, like a lot of people in the counterinsurgency community, thought that the invasion of Iraq was a bad idea, just on strategic grounds, let alone on moral or political grounds. And I also thought it was a bad idea on those grounds as well. But, you know, once things got difficult in Iraq, it became a decision of, you know, which side are you on? Do you want this to fail and lots of Iraqis to die and die horribly, or do you want to help put an end to it?
I want to ask you about something that you say in your book. You write that breaking the terrorist cycle requires the United States to establish patterns of virtue, moral authority, and credibility. And I guess the question is, after what has happened since 2003 in Iraq and the prison abuse scandals and the various deaths of lots of civilians, does the United States really have the virtue, moral authority, and credibility to make this work?
I've often sat with people in Southeast Asia, Afghanistan, and places in Iraq who have just lectured me on the evils of the United States, but they do so while wearing, you know, blue jeans and Nike runners and, as an aside, telling you how they'd like to go and study in the United States and they have a family member. And, you know, people like the United States. They like the American way of life. They like our way of looking at the world. What they don't like, in a lot of cases, is American foreign policy and the way that American foreign policy affects them. And it's not a simple question of, you know, are you with us or against us or why do they hate us? It's much more complicated than that. People feel aggrieved by a lot of policies which they perceive as getting into their own business and trying to control them or adopting sort of an imperialistic approach to their affairs. Does that mean the United States should back off and pull back from the world and become isolationist? I would say resoundingly no, because that's the objective of Al-Qaeda. That's the whole point of what they're trying to do. They're trying to get us exhausted so that we pull back and disengage. I think the alternative is to engage with people in a way that makes them feel like their interests are being followed, and you can't pretend with that. It has to be genuine.
Now, one of the things I found very interesting about your book is you're saying part of the problem that the U.S. has in dealing with this part of the world is that we don't have the right language. We don't have the right words to describe what we're up against. You say we need a new lexicon. How do we need to rethink some of sort of the basic ideas about both what's happening in the Middle East and how to fight a war there, if that's in fact what we need to do?
Well, I think I am against the use of the term jihadi to describe the enemy. A lot of people call them jihadists. Jihad in Arabic means a holy war, and a mujahideen is a holy warrior, which is the term which they used to describe themselves. And, you know, it's just not accurate. And people say, well, that's what they call themselves, so we should call them that. Well, right now we're dealing with pirates off the coast of Somalia. The pirates don't call themselves pirates. They call themselves the Somali Volunteer Coast Guard, okay? But that doesn't mean we should be talking about the people we're dealing with as the Somali Volunteer Coast Guard. You know, call them what they are. They're pirates. These guys are Takfiri terrorists. Now, a Takfiri is someone in Islam who is a heretic, and the heresy of Takfirism is that you declare anybody who doesn't follow exactly the same form of Islam as you to be an infidel, and you then say that that person can be killed. That is what most Muslims call Al-Qaeda. They say that they are Takfiri. That's what Iraqis call them, and a lot of people in Afghanistan and Pakistan call them that. And in 2005, the Muslim world, for the first time in history, reached an unprecedented consensus when King Abdullah II of Jordan got 500 Islamic scholars together, and they all examined Al-Qaeda's doctrine and pronouncements and declared that Al-Qaeda is a heretical sect and that its prescriptions on terrorism and jihad are not to be followed. That's, you know, something that we need to give Muslims credit for. People say, well, we don't see a lot of Muslims speaking out against terrorism. You know, on the contrary, we've actually seen this unprecedented consensus against what Al-Qaeda is doing. And that's had some effect. Since the 2005 Amman Declaration, which resulted from this meeting, we've seen a pretty substantial drop in support for Al-Qaeda. And we've seen a debate in the Muslim world about issues like jihad, which is kind of akin to the just war debate in Christian theology. And we've seen people move on pretty substantially in thinking about these kind of issues. So I'm kind of confident that if we don't make any more fairly egregious errors, that this thing will eventually die of its own contradictions and of its own unpopularity. Nobody who's lived under Al-Qaeda wants to repeat that experience. I can certainly tell you that from talking to Iraqis about it. And I think it's only a matter of time before they collapse, unless they have some external force sustaining their ability to manipulate people. And that force, unfortunately, in a lot of parts of the world until recently has been us. And I'm hoping that we can get out of that and into a more subtle and ultimately more effective approach.
David Kilcullen speaking with Steve Paulson. Kilcullen's the author of The Accidental Guerrilla, Fighting Small Wars in the Midst of a Big One. He's been an advisor to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and was the architect of the troop surge in Iraq under General Petraeus. He's currently an informal advisor to the Obama administration.